Welcome to today's deep dive. We're looking at a stack of policy documents and legal breakdowns around the amended Western Cape Provincial School Education Act of 1997.
Right, the 1997 Act.
Yeah, and our mission for you today is to unpack these sources to see how a regional government basically completely rewired the DNA of its public schools.
It's a pretty profound blueprint, really. I mean, we're looking at texts that outline a system blending traditional public education with, like, private power, intense independent oversight, and some incredibly strict campus policing.
Which is wild. So to understand how these schools actually function on the ground, we kind of have to follow the money.
Always follow the money.
Yeah, exactly. The documents outline two specific models. There's collaboration schools and donor-funded public schools. So what is the actual difference between those two in practice?
Right. So it's an important distinction. In a donor-funded school, a private backer is primarily just injecting capital.
Okay. So just writing a check.
Right. But in a collaboration school, you have a nonprofit operating partner stepping in to actually help manage the school's daily operations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the massive shift here in both cases is in the governance. These outside entities don't just donate money, they can legally secure up to 50% of the voting rights on the school's governing body.
Wait, 50%? Like half?
Literally half the voting power, yes.
I mean, if a private donor or a nonprofit holds half the voting power, what stops them from dictating the curriculum or pushing out staff who don't align with their corporate values? Are we basically putting a corporate board in charge of a local school?
Well, that is exactly the tension the policy tries to navigate. The underlying reason this was introduced, according to the sources, is to solve severe resource deficits.
Right. Schools need money.
Exactly. The public system gets the capital and specialized management expertise it desperately needs. But to your point, giving up that much traditional community control requires a massive counterweight to ensure those private actors don't abuse their power.
So the state has to keep these heavily privatized boards in check somehow.
Definitely.
And according to our sources, that counterweight is the school's evaluation authority.
Mm.
But reading through their powers, this isn't just a guy with a clipboard sitting in the back of math class.
Far from it. I mean, because private money and public trust are intersecting so heavily here, the oversight has to be fierce.
Right.
Evaluators can enter a school entirely unannounced.
Wow.
Yeah. And if they have prima facie proof of mismanagement.
Meaning, like, at first glance, the evidence clearly shows something illegal or corrupt is happening.
Exactly. If they have that, and there's a risk someone might tamper with the records, they can physically seize the financial documents right then and there.
That feels less like an inspection and more like a forensic audit raid.
It really does. But it makes sense. If external donors hold half the voting rights, the state needs a mechanism with real teeth to protect public funds.
For sure. But what really stands out in these documents is how this overarching theme of intense top-down control doesn't just stay in the boardroom.
No, it trickles all the way down.
Right. It shifts control away from the local community and imposes a very rigid environment right down to the daily policing of the students.
Yes. The level of legal accountability mandated by the act creates a highly regulated campus. The safety measures are unyielding.
Like what, specifically?
Well, principals can administer non-invasive drug tests, like urine tests, to students, provided an adult witness is present.
Okay, that's intense.
And if a weapon is seized, it goes directly to the police. There are no internal discipline loopholes. Plus, there is a total ban on any party political activities during school time.
So no campaigning, no rallies, no posters.
Absolutely none of that.
I mean, it sounds like a total lockdown, But then, buried right in the same text, there's this really bizarre caveat.
Oh, the alcohol rule.
Yes. The head of department, meaning the top provincial education official, can legally authorize alcohol consumption on school premises for staff functions.
It seems like a massive contradiction, doesn't it?
Totally. I mean, how does a governing body justify authorizing wine for the teacher's mixer while enforcing mandatory urine tests on the teenagers?
It really comes down to how the act legally demarcates school time versus school property.
Okay, so the physical space itself.
Right. The physical campus isn't inherently a dry zone by default. The law distinctly separates the rigid discipline required for the student's educational environment from the adult employment privileges of the staff after hours.
Ah, I see.
It is entirely about defining who is being managed and when.
So why should you care about a Provincial Education Act? Well, because these documents aren't just local history. They are a real-world case study in what happens when we treat public schools as highly governed, fiercely audited, and partially privately steered institutions.
It forces us to ask what the baseline definition of a public school really is when you introduce, you know, private equity dynamics into the mix.
Exactly. And it leaves you with this to mull over. If private donors can legally hold 50% of a public school's voting power and essentially co-run the institution, how far are we from seeing public schools adopt literal corporate branding?
A scary thought.
Right, like if a tech giant or a bank funds the school, do the students wear their logos? It completely blurs the line between a fundamental civic right and a privatized commodity.
Yeah, definitely something to think about.
For sure, something to ponder next time you walk past your local schoolyard.